Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host, and today's guest is award-winning journalist Barry Estabrook. An editor at Gourmet Magazine for 8 years, Barry Estabrook is the founding editor of Eating Well Magazine and has written for the New York Times Magazine, Reader's Digest, Men's Health, Audubon, and the Washington Post. He's here today to talk about his book, Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. Welcome to Health Watch, Barry Estabrook.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start out with why you decided to write a book on tomatoes specifically.
Well, I'd been covering industrial factory farming for many years and wanted to write a book about it and started to think about the modern industrial tomato. You know, these tasteless, pale-looking things we get in the grocery stores in the off-season. And the more I thought about it, the more I came to see that it was sort of the poster child, in some ways, for everything that's wrong with modern industrial agriculture. I mean, if you strip away all the platitudes that foodies have, you know, about local, sustainable, organic, fair trade, you strip away all those, and you end up with a tomato, and you see that they really do mean something in their absence.
Well, it's interesting that you cite an article in The New Yorker, I think it was 40 years ago, where they're already lamenting the lack of taste in tomatoes. So what's happened to the winter tomato and the tomato in general that we're getting this flavorless fruit?
Well, what's happened, and it's only grown worse since that article, But you're right, that article was interesting in that the same complaints were being filed against tomatoes then as today. What's happened over the past 50 years is that commercial plant breeders, the people that breed for these large industrial farms, have focused their attention really on one thing and one thing only, and that's yield. They want great big fruits, tomatoes, and they want lots of them, and they want them in a condition where they'll be able to ship them. As a farmer said, I don't get paid a cent for flavor. I get paid by the pound, and so that's been the market. And so they basically have been breeding for yield and ignoring much else that was good in a tomato, and still good in a garden tomato.
And in Tomato Land, you make the argument that one of the things that makes a winter tomato so disastrous is the fact that they're being grown in Florida. Why is growing tomatoes in Florida a bad idea? And what is that causing to the tomato other than a lack of flavor that people should be concerned about?
Well, it sounds counterintuitive when you first realize it, but Florida, From a botanical and horticultural point of view, is probably one of the worst places you could choose to grow tomatoes on a commercial basis. There's two primary reasons. One is Florida is notoriously humid year-round. And tomatoes' wild ancestors are from the western coasts of South America, which is desert. And, you know, similarly, you know, a tomato really does well in a dry Mediterranean climate. Think of Spain, Italy, parts of California. They thrive there, but they hate humidity, and everything that likes to prey on a tomato loves humidity. So all of the funguses, all of the wilts, all of the rusts, and all the insect pests thrive. And the second problem with Florida is where tomatoes are growing primarily is sand. Not sandy soil or sandy loam or anything. It's sand, just like on Daytona Beach, and it's as nutritious as sand, which is to say there's no natural nutrients in it. So everything the tomato gets has to be fed to it primarily with artificial chemical fertilizers.
So is there a big difference between California tomatoes and Florida tomatoes in terms of nutrition?
Most of Florida's tomatoes are canning tomatoes, processing tomatoes that are put in cans. What there is, though, the modern tomatoes we get today contain like 30% less vitamin C per 100 grams, 30% less niacin. You go down the vitamins, and they can, you know, everything is lower than a tomato that my mother would have brought home in the 1960s. They've bred out flavor and they've bred out nutrition. The only thing that's the modern tomato beats the pants off the Kennedy administration tomato is in sodium. It's got 14 times as much sodium.
And we all know we need a lot more sodium in our diets.
A lot more sodium and a lot less vitamin C. It's crazy, I know. But again, it comes back to the same reason. They're taking the same package and pumping water into it to get more tomato.
And so are we seeing more fertilizers and pesticide and herbicide use in Florida than we would in California or Italy?
Oh, well, of slicing tomatoes, you know, the ones you buy fresh or you get at a sandwich at a restaurant, slicing tomatoes as opposed to canned. Florida and California have roughly the same acreage. Florida applies 8 times as much pesticides, fungicides, and herbicides, 8 times as much for the same acreage. So that's the only way they can really get a successful crop in Florida is to sort of engage in chemical warfare.
So obviously that has both health consequences for the person consuming it, but I presumably also for the person who's growing it.
Well, it's the people who work in the fields who suffer the most, and there are horrific stories. Because sadly, even though it's against the law, every Florida tomato worker I talked to said that being sprayed, actually sprayed while you're working, is a regular occurrence. There have been cases of horrific birth defects from mothers who were forced to work in tomato fields through their pregnancies. There are numerous cases of people showing up at hospitals with breathing problems because of these pesticides. And then no one really has a handle on, you know, what's going to happen to these people 20, 30 years down the road. Because they're migrant and they don't stick around.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Health Watch, and we're talking today with Barry Estabrook, the author of Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. Barry, there's a quote in Tomato Land, if you've eaten a winter tomato, you've eaten a tomato picked by a slave. And you go into detail about how that's not hyperbole, that's actually a sober fact, and it was a shocking thing to read that chapter, a gripping but shocking chapter to read in Tomato Land. And I was hoping you could share with our listeners how eating tomatoes in winter from Florida is, in a sense, supporting modern-day slavery in the United States.
Well, the person who said that to me was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Florida, a man not, like most U.S. attorneys, not given to hyperbole. And he was said flat out, just like you said, if you eat a winter tomato, you've eaten a fruit picked by the hand of a slave. In Florida, in the past 15 years, there have been 7 major slavery cases successfully prosecuted, and 1,200 people have been freed. And that's just the tip of a very ugly iceberg. And and we're not talking about, you know, virtual slavery or near slavery. We're talking about people being bought and sold like animals, people being shackled in chains at night to prevent them from escaping, people being beaten in the fields for not working hard enough, or beaten if they're too sick or too tired to work, and people being, in some extreme cases, murdered for trying to escape. I mean, it really sounds like 1850, the bad side of 1850, not 2011.
And you even mentioned incidences of owners of these farms going to Mexico and threatening the lives of the family members of people who've escaped the farms.
Well, actually, it's not the owners. The owners of most of the big tomato farms are vast multi-million dollar companies. The owners don't go anywhere near the fields. But they have a system where they basically contract out the labor to these labor contractors, also called crew bosses, and it's that that group of people that will typically actively recruit in Mexican towns and villages, often the same towns and villages they were originally from.
Would it be safe to assume then when there are these prosecutions for human trafficking and tomato growing in Florida, that the people who suffer the consequences aren't the multinational corporations, but they're contracted labor bosses instead?
That's exactly right. In fact, when they did the recent the update of human trafficking law, there was a clause specifically inserted that specifies that owners of farms are not responsible, if slavery is happening on their property if they don't know about it, unlike the owner of a factory or the owner of a restaurant. So it was specifically singled out. So it gives them the ability to, say, oh, shock, I had no idea, this is horrible. Yes, you're right, walk off scot-free while these labor contractors, who are often, only one really shaky rung up the economic ladder from the people that they either enslave or have worked for them.
Well, Barry, you mentioned in Tomato Land another statistic, that there are the same number of human trafficking incidents in the United States as murders each year, but 65% of the murders are solved and only 1% of human trafficking cases are solved. Could you talk a little bit about why you think that's the case, and maybe if there's a bright side to this, what people are doing to organize around the human trafficking issue and the eating of winter tomatoes supporting that?
Well, slavery is one of the most difficult crimes there is to solve, primarily because you need a witness. You need the slave to testify. And in many cases, as soon as they break away or they get free, they they do what I do. They hightail it, get as far away as possible. A lot of times you just don't have a witness to testify. And the second thing is that they're reluctant to prosecutors are reluctant to take on slavery cases unless they're pretty sure they have a good one, because otherwise you're just encouraging the practice. People see that you can get away, so and so got charged and he got away with it, but what matches does that send? So it's just a very difficult what has come to light is just the tip of a really ugly iceberg. The 1,200 people who are freed, there's probably thousands of more that are suffering the same fate. There is good news, and that is that a grassroots human rights group called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Immokalee is a small, down at the heels, Florida city, right in the middle of the southern agricultural belt, has recently put into place a program called the Fair Food Agreement, and convinced the major tomato growers to sign up to it. And in addition to giving the workers a bit of a raise, the program has a zero tolerance for slavery or anything close to it. So, and a system of transparency has been built in. So for the first time, the owners of these big farms have actually, they've come to realize that, even though they might not be legally responsible, they do have a responsibility for what goes on their farms, and they have taken this. It's a giant step from just shrugging and saying, wasn't me, it was a contractor, to saying, I will do my best to make sure my fields, this sort of thing isn't going on in my fields. So that's only been in place really since last November, and which means that this coming year will be the first sort of full year of it, and it will go, it will be a big improvement. I attended one meeting where the director of human resources for one of these large farms was talking to a group of new recruits, And he just basically said to them, he said, look, if you see something that's not right, say something. He says, you can say it to me, you can say it to your boss, you can say it to the coalition. I don't care who you say it to, but if you see something, say something. And that's, you know, again, unheard of. So there is hope, yes.
And you mentioned in Tomatoland as well, Barry, about the campaign for raising the wages of migrant workers by a penny a pound. I think that started with Taco Bell, if I'm correct. But I was surprised to learn that a lot of the fast food companies eventually sign on to this campaign, but the people who really are resisting it are the supermarkets.
Well, that's right. It's the same campaign that also involves the anti-slavery measures that I was just talking about. It's all part of the campaign. And you're right. The coalition started pressing for a penny extra a pound, which doesn't sound much to you or I, but it's the difference between $50 and $80 to a worker on a good day. They're picking 2,000 pounds of tomatoes or more. So it's a huge increase to them, you know, the difference between not being able to feed your family and a crummy but okay survivable wage. And the fast food chains over the past decade or so, one by one, have come aboard, often kicking and screaming. And so have the big institutional food service companies that, you know, feed universities and museums and hospitals. Those have come aboard. But not a single supermarket chain, with the exception of Whole Foods, has agreed. So what that means is half the tomatoes are still harvested the old way, without the penny a pound and without these sort of extra protections.
That's just amazing to me. I mean, I would think that, I mean, I'm good, kudos to Whole Foods, but I'm just kind of amazed that the fast food restaurants would do it, and then the supermarkets would be the barrier. You think the interface with the customer, there'd be a lot of pressure there to get the produce to meet these standards.
Well, it certainly is surprising, and, you know, whether it will change, this coalition is very determined, and they, like I say, they brought over the fast food companies one by one. Thing is, you know, fast food companies spend multi-millions to polish an image, whether it's a smiley, happy clown or a little redheaded girl or a talking chihuahua. They try to, you know, put forth this image of whatever they want, and if all of a sudden that image gets tarnished by something like, you know, refusal to pay a decent price for their tomatoes, or being in, you know, not fighting hard enough against slavery, so they do react, because they, you know, that's so valuable to them. Grocery stores, supermarkets, I guess it hasn't quite reached that point yet.
We're talking today with Barry Estabrook, the author of Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. So, Barry, we know that the winter tomato doesn't taste very good. We know that it doesn't have as much nutrition, that you're being exposed to more pesticides and supporting the exploitation of migrant workers and modern-day slavery. Is the answer, the obvious answer seems to me, to eat, as you said in the beginning about foodies, but it seems like the obvious answer is to eat local and seasonal. Is that not the answer for how we should avoid this travesty in Florida?
Well, I certainly think that that's for many reasons. You know, the very best tomato you can get is the one that's growing closest to your kitchen counter. If you can, you know, have a small garden with six plants in it, or some container pots on your balcony or deck, you know, you can have, they put out tons of tomatoes, and you can keep yourself in really good tomatoes quite easily. Then, you know, one step beyond that is the local farmer's market or farm stand. Again, you know, during the season, they're flooded with great tomatoes that are, you know, in the book I rode with a guy who supplies farmer's market, and he picked his tomatoes on a Tuesday and sold them on a Wednesday. So they were absolutely ripe, absolutely fresh. And, you know, in season, again, if a supermarket has local tomatoes, that's a viable option. But, you know, really a winter tomato is not it's not a tomato. It looks like a tomato. It looks very pretty, but it's not going to give you any flavor. And you know, it's not got the nutrients of a tomato. It's just something red between the slices of bun or in the salad. That's all it's really doing.
One of my favorite chapters in your book is entitled "The Tomato Man," and a man who describes his farm practices as his secret being that he does everything wrong. And I was hoping you could talk about all the things he's doing wrong, in quotes, and tell us really how this is potentially an antidote for this problem of industrial agriculture out of season.
Yeah, he's a farmer who makes a very good, you know, has made a very good, successful living out of supplying Green Market in New York City, and many of the top chefs in the town, in the city, and he uses no pesticides, and all organic fertilizer, which of course is anathema to a commercial grower. He, instead of paying his workers on a piece basis, he pays them a salary and pays them quite well, because as he says, you know, these guys aren't dummies. It's not dummies work, and he sees a value in that. His tomatoes are primarily heirloom varieties, which means they don't taste the same variety to variety. They don't taste the same year to year or week to week. But he's not going for consistency, and he's not going for beauty either. Some of his tomatoes are a little lumpy, as I said, everything he does goes against the grain of this, of what the commercial model is. Picks them fully ripe, sells them the next day, and charges a high price for them.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about how he saves money through not using fertilizers and pesticides, but that extra savings actually has to go into hiring a larger workforce, because he has to do more weeding and other things because of the lack of the pesticides. But he's actually ending up hiring more people and able to hire them on a living wage, which through the extra supposed inconvenience around the lack of pesticides, he's actually creating an economy, it seems like to me.
Yeah, and an economy of decent jobs, more to the point. His workers make between, his interns make $10 an hour, and his senior workers make $15 an hour, and he keeps them around from year to year. And you're right, and he makes a premium product. He charges, it's not, you know, when you look at it, he charges about the same amount you'd pay for little cartons of grape tomatoes in the supermarket per pound, around $3 or $4 per pound. But they're worth it. So it's like everybody kind of benefits in that case. You're right, his workers have real jobs. He makes a living. The consumer gets the same great tomato you would get at a 4-star restaurant in New York City, same tomatoes. So you're getting a quality, top quality product. Everybody wins.
Well, I liked that you also referenced, I think it was a term from Michael Pollan, the artisanal economics, which is the celebration of oddness. And obviously, if you're going to be growing heirloom tomatoes, they're not all going to be round, and they're not all going to have the same consistency and taste, but that's part of the beauty of it.
Exactly, and that allows you to break away from the, you know, what's, you know, the cycle of commodities. If your tomatoes are like a Florida tomato, you know, these companies go out of their way so that you can't distinguish, tomato A from tomato B. In fact, if I were to tell you the names of the growers, you wouldn't recognize one of them, because they don't want they want to produce a tomato that's faceless and brandless and can, you know, go to McDonald's or go to Safeway or wherever. And the only way they can compete with another grower is by having a lower price. So you get, you get in this race for the bottom, and as you get down to the bottom, that's where the workers' abuse comes in, because if you keep cutting your price and your costs are fixed, which in most cases they are, the only place you can really cut back is on labor. So it's a vicious cycle downward. Whereas the an artisanal producer who says, I'm going to do a different tomato, I'm going to brag about my tomato being different from the next guy's, I'll use that as a selling point, and I'll charge, I'll charge a good amount for it. I'll make my price. I won't take what price the market gives me. So that creates a spiral going in the other direction in a good way.
I think you mentioned that 90% of American gardeners are growing tomatoes, and I was curious if what you grow is as a tomato varietal, and if you recommend any for people who want to branch out from the standard ones.
Well, I live in Vermont, so I'm a little tomato challenged. There's about 10 varieties that I grow every year, some just for the fun of it. And the thing about recommending tomato varieties is different varieties grow differently in different areas. And that's why you get all these people having these arguments about whether a big boy is better than a celebrity or whatever, because they probably have very different gardens. And, one tomato is... So it's hard to give advice. What I say is to people is talk to other gardeners or people at the garden, where you buy your plants or buy seeds from a local seed company that's based in your area. All that said, here in the Northeast, there's this big heirloom variety called a Brandywine that is my fallback. Main tomato. It's the main one in my garden. I grow something called a Muscovitch, which is a smaller tomato, but gets ripe really early. Brandywines are take longer, and I grow a few Muscoviches because they're a couple of weeks earlier than the Brandywines .
Barry, we're almost out of time, but I wanted, before the show ended, for you to have a minute just to talk about your blog, The Politics of the Plate, because I think it's a great resource for people who want to learn more about where their food's coming from.
Oh, thank you. It's politicsoftheplate.com, all run together. And that you said it, you basically said it right there. For years, my beat has been showing people where the food comes from, how it's produced, and who produces it, and then letting them make their own decisions, whether it's a tomato or a farmed salmon or an egg. And this is a story I think that modern agriculture doesn't want us to know. They don't want us to know where our food comes from. And modern supermarkets, they really go out of their way to hide that. And so I'm sort of trying to just lift that veil and let you take a look in there and then make your own decisions if you want to buy a winter tomato or an egg from an egg factory.
Well, it was great having you on Health Watch today, Barry.
Well, thank you very much.
We are talking today with Barry Estabrook, the author of Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host, and this has been Health Watch. If you missed part of today's program, later on today or tomorrow, you can go to kboo.fm/healthwatch and listen to the show there or download it. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine.